This is the first session in a series called Geology and the Earth, where the roots of the Tree of Life begin. And the title of today's session is Way Out on the Rim of the Broken Wheel. The session title will become apparent later on, because I'll tell you why I named it that. My name's Don Coberly. This is my first actual minute on the volunteer teaching staff. So if I appear really nervous, it's because I'm really nervous. I came to Holden for the first time in May of 1997 as part of the investigation team for the company that owned the company that owned the company that did the mining here. The company I work for is called Daines & Moore, and in May of 97, that spring, I came up as part of a large group, 10 or a dozen people. Came back again fall of 97 and was here for a little bit last year. That work is still going on. So I'm sort of in the middle of that investigation. I've written the groundwater section. That's what my area of study is. So if any of you would like to know about the progress of the mine investigation and where it is and where it is we may be going, I'll be glad to talk to you about that. I would prefer to do that outside of the session. There will be more. I kind of want to do that away from here, since some people may be interested and some people may not be. I think the reason that I got here on volunteer teaching staff is that both in the spring and the fall of 97, some of us from the Daines & Moore group gave a report to the community. And I was part of the people that did those presentations, and I think Janet and Susan mistook my fright for enthusiasm, because at the end of that year, they talked to Dorothy Bass, who was the volunteer teaching staff coordinator last summer, and suggested that Dorothy might contact me. And since I would like to come and live here someday, I think that any of the ideas that the directors have are sort of essentially really good ideas, just because the directors have them. So, long story short, I didn't come last summer. Dorothy passed my name along to Karen and Jim and Dan, and so here I am. I have a couple of degrees in geology. I've studied geology for a long time. If you want any more details, it's up on the board there by my picture, or you can talk to me about it afterwards. As I was putting together these sessions, I'd sort of had some basic assumptions to sort of direct where I was going. And the first assumption is that you have some interest in geology. That's why you're here. The second is that you're not going to spend your entire life at Holden Village. And so therefore, if you get interested in doing any geology anyplace else, you will necessarily have to do that someplace else. Whether that's taking a community college course someplace, or reading, or going on a vacation next year to the Grand Canyon or someplace else, you're not. We could talk about the geology of the valley here, and do a pretty good job of it over 5 hours, and then next time you were back here, you could explain it to other people and they'd be really impressed. But if you went to the Grand Canyon next year, you'd kind of be lost. And so since there's more of the world that's not Railroad Creek than there is, it made more sense that whatever we would talk about would have some relevance outside of the valley. So those are the assumptions I came into it with, and I had some conclusions written down, and I'm going to flip to them here and try to remember what they were. The first one being that we're not going to talk very much about Railroad Creek Valley. If you want to talk about the groundwater here, I know a lot about that. If you want to talk about the geology here, Rick Dunning knows a lot about that, or Don Ring when he comes by. They know more about that than I do, so ask them about geology, ask me about the groundwater. The main parts of the session this week, and I'm giving a different one next week, I think are basic topics to geology that have relevance everywhere. So, like I said, you can take this down, you can take this with you as, hopefully, after you go away, and the same things will apply wherever you happen to go. The third thing is, I will try as the week goes along to point out resources and that I think are good ones for people who are interested in learning geology and yet don't come from a real geologic background. And if you've had 4 years of geology study, I can recommend a really good book on geochemical thermodynamics. Everybody else goes, big deal, what do I care? So I'll try and point out these resources, books, videotapes, and then talk about if you wish to pursue this more formally through a community college or something like that. Could you flick on that overhead for just a second? Mm-hmm. Maggie is talking about rituals, and I have one to help me sort of get through things, and it's this slide, and I've shown it pretty much every place that I could before I gave a talk. And because I think geology is cool and important and a neat thing to do, that's all well and good, but opinions vary. This was taken, this is a sign at the First Baptist Church in Carl Junction, Missouri, which is suburban Joplin, Missouri. And that's how they feel down there. That geology is not all that, you know, big a deal. So that helps me kind of keep things in a little bit of perspective. So that's, you can turn that off for now. Each of the sessions, most of the sessions, stand on their own, but there is sort of a common thread to the series. And I want to take a second and talk about that and sort of come up with a thesis, I don't know whether I wrote this down, for the series. Okay, I didn't. First off, my concept of the tree of life is that it sort of represents all living things. I think I show some imagination in some ways, but I think my view of the tree of life is relatively straightforward. And when I was putting the sessions together, I talked to some people about it because I wasn't sure whether I had the idea down very well at all. And I woke up this morning about 3:30 because I couldn't sleep thinking about this stuff, and a story came to me that sort of ties in with whether or not I get the tree of life and what it really means. And it's a story that a pastor told about, he was going to have to do a kid's sermon. You know, the little, you know, he sits down, little kids come up and sit around him, and he tells them something, and they take it away, and everybody's happy. And he was driving to church and hadn't put anything together yet, and was under pressure, and he saw a squirrel out on the front lawn, collecting nuts and taking them up the tree. And I thought, okay, I'm on something here. I'm going to talk about the squirrel planning ahead and preparing and doing what needs to be done, because at some point that stuff will be needed. And it gets to time for the kid's sermon, and he sits down and all the kids come up and gather around him, and he starts to tell his story. He said, I was out today and I saw this creature out on the front yard, front lawn, and it was working and it was collecting things and was planning ahead for what was going to come this winter. And, you know, has anybody got any guesses about what it was I saw? And he looked down at, you know, 12 smiling faces and 12 blank sets of eyes. And, okay, so was collecting stuff that had fallen out of the trees, and it was carrying them up to a hole in the tree, putting them there. And same response. And, okay, a long, bushy tail and covered with brown fur and black eyes and black nose and long whiskers. And suddenly, one of the kids started to stir, and it was sort of the first thing, you know, indication of comprehension. And he said, so, have you got an idea? And the child said, well, I know the answer is Jesus, but it sure sounds like you're describing a squirrel. So I kind of have the same feeling about the tree of life, that I know the answer is Jesus, but I've got this picture of all of life being interconnected and being part of the tree. And if you go with my idea, then having the roots of the tree being in geology makes some sense. And if you go with it being Jesus, I don't think it makes any sense at all. So, at least if it does, tell me about it later, because I can't put it together. So the thesis of the sessions is that the solid earth, the thing that we study through geology, has had a tremendous impact on life on the planet, represented by the tree of life. How does it have impacts on life on the planet? Well, if there was a big earthquake today, a bunch of people got killed. Or when Mount St. Helens blew up on May 18, 1980, 53 people are still up on the mountain who were there that day because they got killed. So in that very small scale, geology has an effect on life on the planet. Through the course of geologic history, those effects have been huge. That's my thesis. I will try to provide some evidence for that. We can decide whether or not we still believe it at the end of the week or not. The extinction of the dinosaur 65 million years ago that's been accredited to a comet hitting the planet wiped out a large amount of the life on the planet. There's a reaction of geology with life that didn't turn out very good. So that's the thesis, that the Earth has had effects on life. As a bit of a corollary, life on the planet has had some effect on geology. I'll save talking about that until it comes up through the week. In order to get to some place where we can evaluate the thesis, here's a roadmap. I can't think of anything better to call it. Sort of a plan, a work plan for how we're going to do things this week, and it's sort of in opposite order. This effects of the solid earth on the tree of life, that's my abbreviation for tree of life. This is going to be on Friday, and I think in order to best evaluate that, we have to talk about plate tectonic theory, which is the unifying theory, the comprehensive theory of the science of geology. And as an added benefit, it's something that if you decide to do geology or study geology anyplace else, you're going to have to deal with plate tectonic theory. Everybody, you know, all geology is sort of taught in this framework, and so that's what we need to do. We'll talk about the basic principles of the theory. We'll talk about when plate tectonic theory originally was called continental drift, proposed by a guy named Alfred Wegener back in the 1912 or 1915. A few people thought he was onto something, and a lot of people thought he was bloody nuts. And whatever, 55 or 60 years later, that idea has become the central theory of the science. And I think that's an interesting story. I don't know if it's a sociology story or if it's a history of science story, but it was neat for me to read about how people's opinions change. The primary reason people went from thinking it was a crazy idea to an accepted theory was because there was evidence that sort of supported it. So we're going to talk about that evidence and the clues, and then finally we're going to talk about how it describes what it is we see. The point of a model or the point of a theory is to explain observed phenomena. We go out and we look at things, we find them in a certain way, we find them to be in a certain order, we being scientists, if not people in general, like to have some order to things, and so we come up with a model or a theory. Now that we have the model or the theory, we go out and we find more information. If it fits, we like our theory better. If it doesn't fit, either we collected bad information or the theory is no good and we need to change it. That's the way science theoretically progresses. Part of this part of the story talks about how theory doesn't always match practice, and it's sometimes egos get involved and turf defending gets involved and things like that in science, like it probably does anyplace else. This is Wednesday and Thursday. This is a blank page so that it doesn't show through very well. In order to talk about plate tectonic theory, I think we need to talk about the structure, the composition, and the age of the Earth. That's tomorrow. And in order to talk about that, to make a full story of it, I think we need to talk about the formation of the universe, the Milky Way, which is the galaxy we live in, and our solar system. That's the rest of today. The only other, I think, piece of housekeeping we need to do is talk about the rules. And the rules are ask any question at any point. If it's something that we can answer, that I can answer briefly, and it's in the flow of where we're going, then I will do it in session. Otherwise, I'll ask for you to talk to me like outside of session. And since anybody who's been around me a little while knows that I really can't answer questions simply, we'll probably spend some time outside of session talking about things. And if you've read the stuff I wrote in my biography, or if you've read the session titles, or if you know anything about me, or if you've been around for the last 10 minutes, you understand that I joke about a lot of things. The one thing that I really would like to be serious about is the point of our spending time together is so that you all go away with some better understanding or appreciation of geology. That's completely why I came here. And the rest of it, the overheads and the jokes, is all just frosting. The point of us spending time together is that hopefully I can pass something along to you. And I'm doing sessions for 1 hour a day, and I have 2 hours of garbology and 2 hours of dish team to do this week. That's not a lot of time commitment that Holden has asked of me for letting me stay here for 2 weeks. So please, it would really be disappointing if I overheard you on the boat leaving saying, gosh, I really wanted to know something, but I didn't feel like I could ask that guy. So whenever I'm not sequestered in my room writing the next session, please, if you have a question, track me down and let's go through it. All right, so let's talk a little science for the day. In a second. The study of, the scientific study, I guess, of the universe at large and questions of the formation of the universe are under the science of cosmology. And folks who study that are called cosmologists. And cosmologists have come up, there's a wide enough agreement on sort of the basic formation of the universe, but it's called the standard model. And in all of my studies in science, I've never heard of anything where people agree so much. It just isn't sort of in the nature of scientists to agree that way. So it's interesting that to me there is this thing that people call the standard model, and in some ways it's for the universe the same thing that the plate tectonic theory is for geology. It's a basic framework that we compare observed phenomena to. That's the point of the model. while cosmologists call this the standard model, the rest of us call it the Big Bang. Lay people who don't study cosmology call it the Big Bang. They have heard about it, read about it in magazines or books. The standard model is based primarily in Einstein's general theory of relativity. That talks about the geometry of the universe and the nature of energy within the universe. And make a confession here, I've spent a fair amount of time trying to read and understand Einstein's general theory of relativity, and I can't really make head or tail out of it. Some time that I probably should have been writing my thesis, I was, you know, reading books about it, and or trying to read books about it, and some time I was supposed to be writing a report for Holden, I was doing that. And it's not, whether it's because I take things so literally or for whatever reason, it's just a really, the idea of curved space-time is not one that sticks in my head very well. So as the week goes on and we talk more geology, I think I'm pretty good at evaluating evidence and saying this fits, this doesn't fit, what's the problem here? This first part, based in the general theory of relativity, the Big Bang, and sort of the early history of the universe, I'm essentially taking on faith that Einstein was good at theoretical mathematics, and that there are a couple of sources that I use to put this part together. One called The First 3 Minutes by a guy named Steven Weinberg, who was the winner of the 1979 Nobel Prize for Physics, and another book called The Little Book of the Big Bang by a guy named Craig J. Hogan, who is at the University of Washington. There's also a relatively recent Scientific American, January of 99, that has three articles in it that sort of are the cutting edge of cosmology, one of which Hogan is a co-author on. I found this book to be more readable to my way of looking at things. So. Like I said, we talk geology and I can have a pretty good handle on what the real stuff is. Some of this is strange enough that you can take my word for it, or if you know anything about the general theory of relativity, we can have a cup of tea later and you can explain some of it to me. Okay, the standard model, my reading, starts with the Big Bang, which was an explosion. Thought to occur somewhere between 12 and 15 billion years ago. Now, in one of the articles in the Scientific American, there was a line there that says the universe as we know it expanded from a chunk of radiation less than the size of a turnip. And so my mind immediately goes to this picture of like some dark, darkened lecture hall at Cambridge University with three big blackboards filled with mathematical equations and differential equations and derivatives, and at the end it says less than turnip. Shows how my mind works, but it would be interesting. I at some point would like to be able to go into and do the math, or at least be able to have somebody show me the math that says, okay, what's now the universe at some point was something less than a turnip. Size something less than a turnip. So what, how much stuff got smooshed down to being less than the size of a turnip? This was a question I just asked on my own as I was trying to get through this to try and figure out, you know, this stuff that started the Big Bang was obviously very dense and very hot. How much stuff is in there? So we live in our little solar system, which is made up of the sun and all the planets. The sun comprises 99.9% of the mass of the solar system. So the fact that the planets are here really doesn't matter at all. In our galaxy that we call the Milky Way, there are plus or minus 100 billion stars. And then there are about a million plus or minus known galaxies in the universe. So, let's see. That's a million. So that's a billion, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we got to add two more zeros to that to make 100 billion. And then we got to add six more zeros to make it times a million.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we put in new commas. Hey, it worked out cool. Okay, that many, and let's say our sun is an average size star. I don't know whether that's true, but who cares? That much mass compressed down into something a little bit smaller than a turnip. Inconceivably dense. It's the only way I can think of it. But a lot of stuff. So there's all, you know, everything is like, and some little postal worker molecule had enough, and there's an explosion. And the way it's been, one of the ways it's described is, don't think of this explosion as being from a point and radiating outward. Think of the entire universe exploding at once. Okay. Again, that's one of those things that isn't real apparent to me. So I made up my own idea, which probably has no relevance in reality, but however many matches it takes to make the sun, take that many suns, and you've got the Big Bang. Work? I don't know, but that's the way I think about it from my head. The mathematics that's involved, the first time that any evaluation can be made is after about a hundredth of a second after this initial explosion. The temperature at that point is estimated to be 100,000 million degrees centigrade. I'll take that on faith until I can do math. At that point, most all of the energy in the universe is there as light. Particles don't exist. It's too bloody hot. There are a few particles exist, but there are no molecules, there are no atoms, there are no nuclei of atoms, there are a few protons and electrons, but mostly it's elementary particles, positrons, neutrinos, and photons, which are the little, smaller pieces that in time get together and build up the stuff that then becomes nuclear material. After the explosion, there is the outward force of the explosion. The universe expands, becomes less dense, and cools off. And that is the process that continues 12 to 15 billion years later. One of the references, I think Weinberg talks about different temperatures at different times, 30,000 million degrees at the end of a tenth of a second. By 1 second, it's 10,000 million degrees. And after 3 minutes, it's 1,000 million degrees. A question that came to me as I was reading through this is, okay, I know about the temperature. What's happening to the size of the universe? What size does this relate to? Now, Weinberg doesn't talk anything about it. I had to get this from another source. So there's the potential that since certain people don't necessarily agree about things, the time might not match up completely, or the size might not match up completely with what this guy would think would be happening at that same time. The information I have is that at time equals 1 minute, the universe was a million billion kilometers across. That's another incomprehensibly and unpronounceably large. And after thinking about it for a couple of days, a question came to me early this morning. At 1 minute, the universe is a million billion kilometers across. We know the speed of light. If you take the speed of light and multiply it speed of light is 300 million meters per second, multiply that by a minute, and you get a smaller number than a million billion kilometers across. And so if Weinberg or Craig Hogan were here, that would be the question I would ask them. And if any of you get into their classes, I would ask you to ask them that question. How, my understanding always has been that the speed of light is as fast as things can travel. Except I've got a bigger number here at the end of 1 minute than light can travel in that same time frame. And I think they'd say, why don't you talk to me after class? At the point after the first 3 minutes where the universe, the temperature of the universe is about 1,000 million degrees centigrade, at that, it is cool enough theoretically at that point for protons and neutrons to form to become nuclei. It's not yet cool enough for electrons to form or be attracted to those nuclei to form atoms. The earliest form nuclei were deuterium, which is heavy hydrogen, one proton and one neutron, and helium, which is two protons and two neutrons. And those elements, or once they form elements, hydrogen and helium, are by far the largest mass elements that we find in the universe. So those things were present very early on. Time goes on. The universe continues to expand and cool and decrease in density. And after a few 100,000 years, somewhere between, one of the references says 300,000, another one says 700,000, it's cool enough for the electrons to join the nuclei and form atoms of hydrogen and helium. And I don't know whether it's connected to that or not, but at the same time, the universe sort of becomes transparent. Up until that point, the universe is essentially opaque. Light doesn't escape from it. The reason for that is the things that sort of create or carry light are called photons. Little particles that have an energy to them, but no mass. And since it's really hard to tell them apart, we think of light as being a wave when it's really these little packets of energy. In the early universe, photons couldn't go very far before they'd run into something and change. They'd either run into an electron with a greater energy and be deflected, or into an electron with less energy and go off, shooting off from it and combine with something else. So for the first period of the time of the universe, no light sort of escaped the outside edges. And then at about somewhere between 300,000 and 700,000 years, the universe becomes transparent, and there was this propagation of light in all directions, sort of, I assume that the expansion of the universe is spherical, and so all of a sudden it was sort of like the shutters being taken off of this sphere, and light took off in all directions. We'll talk about that in a minute, because it's detection of that light that helps cosmologists believe that they think they know what they're talking about with the Big Bang.
So that would mean that it slowed down below the speed of light now?
Apparently. I assume that, one of the questions, and I'll get to that, I'll bring it in a little further in just a second, is the universe still expanding? Yes. Is that rate of expansion increasing or decreasing? It's hard to say. But it's certainly, apparently it's certainly slowing down from whatever that early time was. Once the hydrogen and helium atoms were formed and started to clump together a little bit, there was the first time in the history of the universe that gravitation started to have an effect. And the history of the universe since then has been, there are only two major forces in the universe. One is the outward thrust or explosion of the Big Bang, and the second one is gravity, which is the attraction that every mass has for every other mass. Those are the only two sort of universal long-range forces out there. There are molecular interactions and there are magnetic attractions and things like that, but those are relatively short-range. So, at about somewhere between 300,000 and 700,000 years ago, the universe has become transparent, light has been emitted, and gravitational forces, for the first time, have the ability to affect what goes on. I've tried to choose what I say carefully. I've talked about the formation of the universe rather than the creation of the universe. Part of that is because in reading the stuff related to the Big Bang, there's a question. I don't know if it may relate a little bit to what Dan said, but it got me thinking about it. If the universe continues to expand and it's expanding more rapidly now, that indicates that this was sort of a one-shot deal. That this is, we had this Big Bang and things keep getting farther apart and it's going to continue on. And at some point, things are going to become cold and dead. And there's a branch. This is where the standard model, you start to have people choosing up sides on it and saying, no, it doesn't work that way. It works this way. There, the other main camp is that this is sort of a cyclical thing. That there's this Big Bang explosion, and material is thrust outward for some immense period of time. At some time, the effects of gravity overwhelm the outward explosive effect of the Big Bang, and things start to go back together over another unbelievably long period of time until you go back to the small, less than a turnip, and the whole thing starts over again. My question is, what happened the day before? Either the first Big Bang, if there was only one, the Big Bang, if there was only one, or the first Big Bang, if this is a cyclical thing. And if it's a cyclical thing, or I guess in both cases, what caused that initial explosion? And I don't think there is anything, there certainly isn't anything that I've read or seen or heard that gives any satisfactory answer to that question. So, while I'm to some degree comfortable that the Big Bang explains how the universe as we know it today was formed, I don't have any idea about how the universe was created. If somebody figures that out, we will all hear about it. They'll get the Nobel Prize. They'll quit giving them out after that. So that's kind of why I think that nobody has really come up with a compelling or a defensible argument for what the creation of the universe is. And I don't know whether science is at all capable of handling that. So that's a lot of people say, well, the universe was created in the Big Bang. The what I've read and what I believe doesn't indicate that that's the case. What the Big Bang, what's the evidence? Why on earth should we believe anything this fantastic with only this theoretical underpinning of mathematics to go by? There are two things. One is that the universe is the Big Bang means two things are necessary. That the universe is expanding and that 12 to 15 billion years ago there was a big explosion. How do we know the universe is expanding? The first way that this was proposed or sort of hinted at was back in the 1920s by the guy named Hubble, who they named the telescope after, and I can't remember what his first name is.
Edward
Hubble. And the initial observed phenomena was when you take pictures of the sky over some period of time, galaxies seem to move apart from each other. And what Hubble saw in his early looking at things was that the dimmer galaxies seemed to get farther apart from each other than the bright galaxies did. And so he was trying to come up with an explanation for why that is. And if the universe is expanding, if at let's look at a close by galaxy. In 1905, here's the picture, and 10 years later in 1915, those galaxies have moved out radially, and now the galaxies appear to have gone this way, right? Because they're going out on this sphere, essentially. And as the radius increases, the circumference increases by something related to pi that we could figure out if we wanted to. And the farther out you are from where the observer is, the bigger over that same period of time, even though, I mean, this distance and this distance should really be the same, but because the circle has gotten bigger, this distance apart that these appear to move gets larger. As time has gone on, that has been formalized. Looking at galaxies and figuring out which ones are bright and which ones are dim is pretty, not very quantitative, it's qualitative. But as time has gone on, cosmologists have been able to assign actual luminosities to galaxies, and this theory or this observation holds. The other way, and what's become a more precise way of looking at the expanding universe, is what's called the redshift of light, which is analogous to the Doppler effect for sound. The Doppler effect for sound is, if you go out and stand by the railroad track, as the train's coming towards you blowing its horn, it sounds a little bit higher pitched. And as the train passes and goes away from you, the pitch decreases, right? I've been able to experience that lately through some work near a railroad track. The reason for that is, as the train is coming towards you, each time it generates a new sound wave, it has gotten closer to you than it was before. Therefore, that sound wave doesn't have to travel as far as the one before it. And so it has a net effect of compressing the sound waves as they get to you. Shorter wavelength is higher pitch. As the train passes you, now the opposite process is in effect, and each successive sound wave has a little bit longer to go, and therefore the wavelength increases, it sounds lower. There's a completely analogous situation to light waves. It's called, as the wavelengths get stretched out, there is a larger red color component to them, because red is longer wavelength light. As the opposite effect is the blue shift, which is as things get, if things are coming towards you, the light gets shifted a little more towards the blue end, which is a shorter wavelength. Through shining light through a prism, you can split things up into its component wavelengths, and it's through a comparison of light from the sun that we assume to be in relatively equal distance to us over time to the light patterns from other galaxies. Those that show more red are going away from us. Those that show more blue are coming towards us. The vast majority of those are going away from us. Therefore, there is some evidence that the universe is expanding. Any questions at this point? Okay. There is the other bit of evidence for this big explosion 12 to 15 billion years ago. Comes from a thing called the cosmic background radiation. if you shoot a radio telescope into the sky everywhere or anywhere, there is this little bit of static out there that you can't account for through the equipment or through the things you're looking at. And so the question came, does this static represent some energy from the original Big Bang? Through an equation, Planck's equation, Max Planck, another Nobel Prize winner, came up with an equation for what's called black body radiation. Through taking the observed phenomena of this cosmic background radiation, it completely fits Planck's equation when the equation are what the Big Bang says they should be at that moment the universe became transparent, a temperature of about 3,000 degrees Kelvin. And the equation is based, the only variable in it is temperature. So, and the equation was derived not for use to explain the Big Bang. It's just sort of one that happened to be out there for some other purpose. And so what is implied there is because of the preciseness of the match of the cosmic radiation, when you do the same thing to it, you split it into its component wavelengths, it fits the model better than any other observed phenomenon fit any other model in the history of science. It gives cosmologists some contentment that it accurately describes the Big Bang, or at least what was going on at that time, 300,000, 700,000 years ago, when the universe became transparent and light was emitted for the first time. So it's about a two-step thing to get there, but since all of the steps seem consistent and they're independent of one another, it's highly unlikely that has happened without there being some truth to that.
So how long ago did you say that the Earth was transparent?
Sorry, 300,000 to 700,000 years after your birth. Mm-hmm. So 12 to 15 billion minus 300,000. Okay, so back to the story of the expanding universe. At this point, hydrogen and helium both exist in the universe. There is some chance for gravity to come into play. Now, if space were completely homogeneous, the same in all directions, perfectly homogeneous, we wouldn't need to worry about it because we wouldn't be here. There would be one particle of stuff per every big piece of space and nothing ever would have come together. So how is it that things get clumped into these little areas or little eddies or little discontinuities or inhomogeneities in space? And the way I think about it is by analogy to a glass of water or a jar of water that we assume to be the same in all directions. And so therefore, if you put a drop or two of food coloring in it, there should be some sort of general perfect redness go down through the water, and that would be the end of it. That within a few seconds, the entire bottle of jar of water would be pink, and it's not the way things seem to work out. So the conclusion about the jar of water, and I think the conclusion about space is as well, that it's not perfectly the same in all directions, that there are these little currents and eddies and dead spots, and that's the thing. And it doesn't have to be very different. It can be within a percent, you know, the same in different directions, and you still get these little waves and little swirls and places where the red stuff doesn't get to for quite a while. So I think that's the source, or that's the way I think about the source of this initial moving together of mass of hydrogen and helium. And after that, gravity comes into play, and it's sort of a kick-starting cycle. Once the process is started, it gets stronger as time goes on. So now we have material sort of clumping together in various places in space, and it should be time for galaxies to start to form. And so how is it that galaxies start to form? And from Weinberg, here's a brief description of how that happens. This is not to say that we actually understand how galaxies are formed. The theory of the formation of galaxies is one of the great outstanding problems of astrophysics, a problem that today seems far from a solution, but that is another story. Any questions about how galaxies are formed? If smart guy, Nobel Prize winner, doesn't know, we're probably not going to get it here in the next 20 minutes. So, I don't know how galaxies are formed. All I know is that that we sort of believe that we're in this spiral galaxy. We got here somehow, and this spiral galaxy is called the Milky Way. And I've got a few handouts that start writing about here. And if you grab one and tape them along. And this first overhead and copy that you have is a picture of another spiral galaxy that we believe our Milky Way galaxy is something like. This is the spiral galaxy in Ursa Major is what it's called. And this is the picture that came to my mind, or I guess this is what I think of when I hear the title, way out on the rim of the broken wheel, is a line from a song by a Canadian songwriter called Bruce Coburn. And he's a songwriter I like very much. And I think it's sort of his visual picture of where we happen to be with the spiral galaxy seeming to be like a broken wheel. And then after thinking about it for a long time, I also think he has some sort of social commentary about how we've broken the wheel that binds us all together. And maybe somebody is talking about that in some of the other sessions that are being done this week. There are a couple other handouts that you have that look good to me. And this is Catherine Smith did this, wrote this back in 1981. So she.
I thought I was five.
That's not true. But this shows various spot in space that has a number of different types of galaxies in it, and a schematic view of what we assume our galaxy, the Milky Way, looks like. And I have one other picture that's part of a two-page thing. Is that right? The way that we view the Milky Way is sort of as this bright band of lights when you look up on a night when you hike away from the village a little bit. And that bright sort of stripe of lights is the axis of the Milky Way, so that you're looking through the long portion of the Milky Way, and therefore there are more stars to get in the way of what you're seeing. And when you turn away from that, you're looking sort of up and down through the galaxy, and there are fewer stars there, so it's not as bright. Where are we on time?
A little before six.
Sorry?
It's a little before six.
So we don't know how galaxies form. No big deal there. We'll just figure out that they did, and therefore it became possible for our solar system to form somewhere. We think that we're in one of the spiral arms of the spiral galaxy that we call the Milky Way. If we're going to have a model or a theory or a hypothesis for the way the solar system formed, there are five things we need to... The theory, the model, needs to explain observed phenomena. First thing it needs to explain is the rotation, and you've got a schematic of the solar system in your packet. For those of you that haven't spent much time with it lately, like me, all of the planets, the nine planets that make up the solar system, I think, Pluto's still a planet, right? There has been some fight about that lately, but it's still on board. They all rotate around the sun in the same direction. If you look down, sort of the way we look down on the North Pole, everything rotates counterclockwise. So our theory needs to explain that. The second thing is most of the planets, Uranus and Venus are the two exceptions, revolve in the same way they rotate. As you look down, they are revolving counterclockwise at the same time they're rotating counterclockwise. Uranus and Venus do it the other way around, so they revolve clockwise while they rotate counterclockwise. Third thing is the distance to the sun. Each planet is about twice as far away from the sun as the next planet in. And that's a reasonably regular pattern, and therefore, as scientists, we think there must be some explanation for it. Other things about the rotation is the orbits that the planets rotate in are essentially, but not perfectly, circular. They're a little bit elliptical, and they're almost all on the same plane. Is it Pluto that's way off on the angle? So we need to account for that. The next thing is the angular momentum of... we need to explain the distribution of angular momentum in the solar system. Now, angular momentum is a product of the mass of a body and its velocity and its distance from the center. And the way to think about that for me is to think about a figure skater who's doing a spin. And when they hold their arms out, they spin relatively slowly. As they bring their arms in, with the formula being mass times velocity times distance from the center, when you bring your arms in, you bring some of this mass a closer distance to the center. The skater doesn't get any bigger or any smaller when this happens. The mass doesn't change, the distance decreases. What happens? Velocity increases, right? So when somebody does this in their spin, they start spinning way faster. So that's the concept of angular momentum. The thing about the solar system is, while most of the mass, 99.9% of the mass, is in the sun, most of the angular momentum of the solar system is out in Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. How does that happen? I don't know, but we better be able to explain it with our hypothesis. And the last thing is the composition of the planets themselves. The interior planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, are all relatively dense planets. Specific gravity of 4 or 5, something like that, 4 or 5 times the weight of water. The outer planets are relatively light, 1 to 1.7. They're made up of ammonia and helium and hydrogen. So whatever theory we come up with, or somebody else comes up with, better be able to explain all of those phenomena, or it should be discarded. First hypothesis about the formation of the solar system was from Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher and did everything. And he called it, or somebody soon afterwards called it, the nebular hypothesis. And I can't see why we've had any conversation since then, because he called his publication The Universal Natural History and Theory of the Heavens, or An Essay on the Constitution and Mechanical Origin of the Whole Universe, Treated According to Newtonian Principles. And I would just think with a title like that, it would put any discussion to rest. As it turns out, there were problems with his hypothesis. They went out of favor for a while. One of the guys who was responsible for killing his hypothesis had his own hypothesis. The nebular hypothesis is that there somehow was this sphere of gas out in space. It began to rotate. Neither of those, how it got there and why it started to rotate, were not explained. But through that rotation, it began to flatten into a disk and get hot. And material went towards the center and became some proto-star. And remaining material was either sort of left behind during the contraction or sort of spit back out to form rings around this central star. The rings coalesced into the planets, and the center material became the star. There are some problems with that. The angular momentum doesn't get conserved. That's the primary thing. The guy that proved that had his own theory, which was at some point some other star came past our star and ripped out a bunch of material, either as chunks or as tons of material, and they all kind of got left trailed behind this star in these little globs, and they formed the planets. Over time, we've come to understand that hypothesis has some problems as well. The angular momentum problem still remains. Pulling gobs out of the sun, those bits probably were hot enough that they would have been blown out into space anyway. We have come back to the nebular, or cosmologists, I guess, have come back to the nebular hypothesis with the additional ideas that denser material, that in fact there was a hot disk of material, the sun at the center of it, relatively denser and higher boiling point material came out of gas near the sun. Any lighter fraction of that stuff got blown further away. These grains, little grains of material, became clumps of material, ran into each other, and became what are called planetesimals, which are sort of little bits of planets. At some point, those planetesimals collected or generated enough gravity that now, as they went through space, they sort of sucked up everything along their path as they continue to rotate. And let's see, does it explain the rotation? Yeah, maybe. It makes sense that everything rotates in the same direction. What about the elliptical nature versus the circular nature? There is an idea that there was a supernova, a star that exploded, and for some period of time generated as much energy as a galaxy normally does, relatively close to the sun. The blue material and caused this initial collapse of the disk. I don't know enough about space physics to know if you have an explosion here, whether that would have a tendency to compress or flatten out an ellipse is a flattened out circle, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have an explosion here, blowing stuff this way, does that mean that you may be able to do that to the orbits? I don't know. Made sense to me the day I thought it up. revolution, 7 of 9 planets rotate in the same direction, or revolve in the same direction, 2 of them don't. Is it possible that as those planetesimals were collecting up stuff, enough material hit it on one side? You know, if you're heading through space this way, if enough junk that you run into hits you on this side and you start spinning the opposite way. I don't know, that's another idea I just made up while I was thinking this stuff through. It does seem to explain the composition probably better than anything else out there, but the bottom line is there is no widely agreed upon theory for the formation of the solar system. So, to summarize in 2 minutes, we have an idea based on theoretical math about the formation of the universe, and I have cautioned you that it has little to do with the creation of the universe. Weinberg, the Nobel Prize guy, doesn't have any idea about how galaxies were formed. We have some hypotheses about how the solar system was formed that meet some of the criteria but seem to have some holes in them. And we're left with the close, which is what I consider to be about 5 billion years ago, this planetesimal proto-Earth revolving around the sun, having gotten there by a bunch of ways that aren't really well understood. So that we covered from 12 to 15 billion years ago to 5 billion years ago, so we got 7 to 10 billion years done. If we keep going at this rate, we'll be done about 45 minutes into tomorrow's session and can then go throw pots for the rest of the week. So that's all I got for today. So if there's any questions, I'll be glad to talk to you after session.